This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from John Word of the Baton Rouge Advocate, featured today regarding the Beatles in New Orleans. Paul and John and Ringo and George came to City Park on September 16, 1964, and one of those present on that evening, that Wednesday night, for $5 was Jerry Teasley, and she is with John Word. We'll talk with them about Then and Now and the Beatles' amazing longevity. Also on the show, the writer Jacqueline Woodson, one of the outstanding young African-American writers of today. Her latest work is Brown Girl Dreaming. And Thomas Groves, Assistant Commissioner of Administration, on the controversy regarding the Office of Group Benefits. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local dial. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing. Today is the 12th day of September 2014, and we're 4 days short of a 50-year anniversary of the Beatles coming to New Orleans in 1964, when the Beatles became an international sensation, starting with the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th of that year. And we'll talk with Jerry Teasley, who was at City Park in New Orleans on that day in 1964, and John Word of the Advocate, who has written about it in today's newspaper. John also has a story about Cosmo Matassa, the French Quarter recording studios were hit factories in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and a giant in New Orleans and around the world. Matassa died yesterday. He was 88 years old. John Word, he left quite an indelible mark on music here and everywhere else.
Yeah, all around the world, because Cosmo operated the studios in the French Quarter where Alan Toussaint, Aaron Neville, Fats Domino predominantly, Lee Dorsey, Dr. John, so many people in New Orleans music and beyond New Orleans music, including Little Richard, recorded at Cosmo Matassa's studios in the French Quarter. He had two studios, two locations there.
He was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2012, and that's high cotton. Doesn't get much better than that.
He got quite a few honors, and I think one of the things in the story is that he says, yeah, the honors are nice, but I love the people. Mm-hmm. I love the people I worked with. And he said they had, mm-hmm. he said everyone, just about, who came into his studio really put their soul into what they were doing.
And the studio was on North Rampart Street.
The first studio, and then the second studio was on Governor Nichols Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he was a giant, and I'm sure he will get appropriate tributes, and John Word has given him quite an obit in today's paper. You got a lot of space today to write about Cosmo.
27 column inches, if I'm not mistaken, and he deserves more than that. I heard there might be a full-length biography of Cosmo Matassa, but I'm not certain about that. I think someone's working on such a book, and it's quite a worthy mm-hmm. subject.
Well, speaking of Rampart Street, it was on this date in 1994, 20 years ago today, that Pat Screen, the former mayor of Baton Rouge, died at a hotel on Rampart Street. He was the victim of an overdose of drugs. He battled substance addiction for much of his life, but he was a great athlete. And in fact, when the Beatles were preparing to perform in New Orleans in 1964, Pat Screen was the starting quarterback at LSU. He had been a legendary high school player at Jesuit High School in New Orleans, and he was elected mayor of this city when he was all of 37 years old, appeared to be on his way to being governor and perhaps much more, but his problems personally enveloped him and ultimately led to his death at the age of 51. But he was quite a man, taken much too soon, and obviously of his own hand, but he is a person who had a fabulous family, who stood by him through thick and thin, and all these years later, 20, he is still remembered reverently for his athletic gifts and for his leadership of this city. And when he was quarterbacking the Tigers in 1964. The LSU at this time was getting ready for its opener against Texas A&M on the Saturday and on the Wednesday before in City Park, where Pat Skreen had played as a prep star. The Beatles came to town, and John Wirt, you've got the ticket in today's Advocate. $5, that was a lot of money in 1964, wasn't it?
One of the ladies I talked to said that her father, she had a very vivid description of her father, who was a doctor, an eye doctor. I'm trying to remember right now. He stood in line for 4 hours to buy the tickets at Worlines on Canal Street in New Orleans, and he was stunned and amazed that they cost $5 a piece. He spent $20 that day for the lady I talked to, her two little brothers who were even younger than her, she was only seven, and their mother, and the four of them went to the show at City Park. So yeah, think back to 1964, $5 was it $30?
Oh, at least, yeah. The average income in the United States in 1964 is about $6,000 a year. Today it's probably...
So how about an average weekly salary in 64? What might that have been?
Probably a little over $100 a week would be the average in 1964.
Okay.
So adjusting for inflation. Yeah. 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 It's at least. But today, if you see Paul McCartney in the Superdome next month, it's probably over $100 to see him.
I'm sure there are tickets that are over $100. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, that's for the nosebleeds.
Are you going to go see Sir Paul?
Well, get closer to the microphone.
Yes, we're going to see Sir Paul. We saw him when he came before. It was very, very good. And we're going to go again.
Well, this is Jerry Teasley, who was at City Park 50 years ago next week, September 16th. It was bedlam, wasn't it?
Yeah, it got to be. Yeah, we got there really, really early. I'm not even sure what time the concert started, 7, 8? You know, and we were there at noon, and there were already people in line to get in. Lots of people in line already.
Well, according to the ticket, by the way, this is a real ticket, John. It looks like it's in pristine condition here, 8 o'clock.
I believe this ticket was supplied by Bruce Spizer, and Bruce is a Beatles historian. He's written several books, and I think someone in New Orleans who went to the show gave Bruce this ticket because Bruce is a collector and a historian.
Well, it's 8 p.m., and there were warm-up acts, and we'll get to John and Jerry regarding those. But it says, interestingly, good only Wednesday evening, as though the Beatles would be back Thursday night or Friday night. They didn't come to City Park that often.
Well, you should remember that this is an outdoor concert. And
right.
one of the wrinkles in the thing, if it had rained or something, the people who produced the show would have lost everything. I think something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was pandemonium in City Park, as you see the photographs and some great ones in The Advocate today, a sea of white faces.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a black person in the crowd.
Well, you know, there was a black musician. Now, this is Deacon John. I would say Deacon John is more of a Creole. You know, in Louisiana, mm-hmm. we have whites, blacks, we have Creoles, we have Cajuns. I would characterize Deacon John more as a Creole person of New Orleans. But he considers himself black, and one of the things he always says when he talks about how he went to see this concert, he said he was the only black person there, and he thought of himself as a fly in a bowl of milk.
That's a great line, isn't it? Well, the warm-up acts, and I guess they actually started at 8 o'clock, included some pretty heavy hitters, but nobody really was there to see Jackie DeShannon. And
not really, no.
Little love in your heart and all this. But what time did the Beatles finally take the stage?
I have no idea. Do you know, John?
The reports that I saw and what I quote in the story is 9:25. Approximately 9:30. Does that sound about right, Jerry?
I'll tell you what, it was really a blur to me. You know, it surprised me that there were actually any other acts besides the Beatles because nobody cared. I mean, literally nobody mm-hmm. cared. We were out there, people were screaming, "Get off the stage, we don't care."
Yeah. Well, Jerry, as you can see, John is a beautiful lady, and she looks something like a female Paul McCartney would. And And I understand that, that came up on that day.
It did. It did. You know, we went down there. It was me and my friend Denise and her little sister Sonia and her little brother Byron and their mother Rosalie, who was, we would always say, was just a big kid too. And she took us down there. In fact, you know, she might have even bought my ticket. I can't remember because, like we were saying, $5 was a lot of money back then. But she wanted us to all go together, so we went. And Rosalie actually won a ticket. They had a contest on WTIX, and she won a ticket. So she got to sit on the ground, you know, the little group, mm-hmm. that little wonderful little group that got to sit right in front of the stage. Rosalie was one of those people. But that meant she left a couple of kids with another couple of little kids to fend for themselves all day long. So we were kind of lost. We didn't really know what to do, but you know, it was pandemonium. Just
well, did
like
you
said.
Encounter the Beatles?
Yes, we did. We did. We were, you know, out there in the crowds. Of course, it was a football stadium, you know, and you were sitting just in the you know, bleachers, and I, you know, it was just like all of a sudden the Beatles came on and they were playing, and it sounded like they were playing like all sped up, like everything was fast, 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 and the crowd went crazy. And that's when everybody started jumping over the you know, the banisters and running down on the field, and the cops had to come out, and you know, cops on horseback, all this. And Sonia, who was probably about 7 or 8 years old at the time, just started freaking out. I mean, she just started crying and screaming. People were shoving us and pushing us, and I didn't know what to do. And Denise and her little brother were going in one direction. We were going in another direction. So I grabbed Sonia and I said, come on, come with me. We'll just go down here. And we just went under the stadium. Because, you know, I didn't know where to go to get away from the people.
What happened under the stadium?
Well, when we got under the stadium, there were limousines parked there. And it, you know, it just didn't dawn on me because, you know, like I was, I guess, in shock. I don't know. Not
you
thinking.
You were about 12 years old.
So I wasn't thinking really clearly. But we just stood there and waited. And, you know, we didn't even get to hear the end of the concert. I mean, I think there was probably another 20 minutes of concert left because that's what I read in the paper. Mm-hmm. And we didn't hear any of it because we were down under the stadium just sitting there, and I was trying to calm Sonia down. And all of a sudden, just out of the left, you know, my left, I hear all this noise and I see people, and it's the Beatles, and they're running. And they're running right towards the limo, which we're standing right in front of.
Yeah.
And someone opens the door, and I'm like standing at the door, you know, just and they're all getting in the limo. And I mean, I could reach out and touch them. I didn't. I wish I had, but I didn't. And one of them says, "Hey, Paul, she looks a bit like you."
One of the Beatles said.
One of the Beatles said.
That sounds like something Ringo would say.
I think it might have been Ringo. but you know, but that was very short-lived. My joy at being face-to-face with the Beatles was short-lived when I suddenly heard from behind me what sounded like thundering hooves, and it turned out to be thundering hooves because it was a New Orleans police officer on a horse, followed by about, I don't know, 100, 200 people.
Well, remember, this would have been less than 6 months after the Kennedy assassination.
Right,
so obviously,
right.
Security was a concern for prominent people.
Right.
And people...
But we were kids. We didn't know security. We didn't know anything. We were just, you know, we were so excited and so crazy. I can't even remember, like, what I was feeling. I think I was just in shock. You know, it was like watching an accident happen.
Euphoria. Euphoria. Look at these photos in John's story today.
And I want to say that we have many photos in today's Red section, and online we have many photos, and we have a photo gallery, which is really extraordinary. It's by an award-winning photographer of the 1960s, Ted Rozumalski, and he shot for National Geographic, Time, Life magazine. He won so many awards, and we got permission from his son to run a gallery of his photos from the Beatles concert in City Park in 1964, and they are really extraordinary, and I hope you can glance at them because maybe it'll bring some memories back.
Yeah.
All right, we're 297-5633. We're remembering the Beatles. 1964, and this is how they sounded 50 years ago at City Park in New Orleans and everywhere else where they performed. We'll talk more with John Word of the Advocate and Jerry Teasley, who was there, when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with John Word, the entertainment writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate, and Jerry Teasley, who was at City Park, September 16, 1964, when the Beatles came to New Orleans. In those days, most of the big acts who came to the city stayed at the Roosevelt Hotel, and my uncle managed the Walgreens, which was right next door. My mother and father worked there, and so I would occasionally see some of these people as they would come in the drugstore and go to the soda fountain or go upstairs to the cafeteria. But the Beatles, John Word, they didn't stay at the Roosevelt. They stayed at the Congress Inn on Chefman Tour Highway.
That's correct. They wanted to stay at the Roosevelt, but one of the reports I read from the archives, the manager or the owner of the Roosevelt didn't want the Beatles there because he was afraid there would be pandemonium and little girls would be screaming all over the hotel and they would be injured. That was his fear, and that's why the Beatles did not stay at the Roosevelt.
They stayed on Chefman Tour Highway.
And it another one of the reports I had was that their manager, Brian Epstein, was appalled that they were staying in a one-story motel, and indeed it was mobbed.
At the Congress Inn, and not far from where Jane Mansfield died a few years later in a car accident. From where the Beatles were staying on that night in 1964. What was their first song? What did they first perform?
I don't have the set list in front of me. It might have been Twist and Shout.
I don't have any idea, you know. I Want to Hold Your Hand, maybe. You know, that was a big thing.
Well, Jerry, you were there. Could you actually hear the music?
It sounded so horrible. It sounded, you know, to me, even back then, although I wasn't like an audiophile, you know, but it just was so tinny. You know, and you could just barely hear the music. But, because let's face it, back then, the speaker systems and stuff were not much, you know. But, and especially in that big, actually open
stadium
area.
Stadium, right.
No, it was bad.
Well, I didn't see it. I was only six at that time. But the next year, I went to that same stadium and saw Michael Landon, Little Joe, and he was mobbed. The star of Bonanza.
I did not know that, Jim. I had no idea that he made an appearance. But it seems he was probably a teen idol as well.
He was. Yeah. He was. And then Bonanza. The women were swooning.
I didn't know that
they
either.
They were swooning over Little Joe. Now, I don't think they would have over Hoss, but they really liked Little Joe.
I don't think they swooned over Little Joe the way they did over John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
It was pretty amazing. And notice all these boys in the crowd. In the photographs, John Worth, they kind of look like Paul McCartney. They have the hairstyle, and the Beatles took the world by storm. Everybody wanted to be like the Beatles.
Yes, it was an extraordinary thing. What we're talking about is in 1964, as I say in my story, is full tilt Beatlemania.
Oh, yeah. There was a sea change, you know, in music that the Beatles just ushered in. I mean, let's face it. You know, we were listening to the Bill Black Combo, you know, who was one of the acts that were, you know, that preceded the Beatles at this concert. And that kind of music, you know, the blues, the jazz, the R&B, right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Beatles just changed everything.
That's absolutely true, Jerry.
All right. Yeah. Thomas Larpenter writes, tickets to McCartney next month on the floor at the, it's at New Orleans Arena, actually.
Mm-hmm. No, Smoothie King Center, it's called.
Yeah. The Tom Benson, one of his pieces of his empire. $225 per person. Going later in the same week to see Ringo Starr and his all-star band at the Hard Rock in Biloxi, Thomas writes. I don't know what the tickets are going for there, but probably less than $225.
Hmm. In the accounts that I read the late Anne Price went to this press conference at the Congress Inn on Chefman Tour, and she and her son Ted, who was 16, went there, and they attended the press conference, and Anne I'm trying to remember now. And covered the press conference for the Advocate, the Morning Advocate, it was called at the time. And Ted went there, and Ted shook the hands of all four Beatles. And the next day at Lee High School, all the girls at school wanted to shake Ted's hand.
Were you heartbroken, Jerry, when the Beatles broke up?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody was. You know, but they went on to do really great things. You know, Paul McCartney, John Lennon did their own thing. But, you know, it was just one of those things. You know, everybody was breaking up, it seems like. But the music is still good, mm-hmm. you know.
What did you think of their work after they were apart?
Well, that's a good question. I think the Beatles was one thing, and what they did, the four of them together, was great, and it can never be duplicated. They went on, and they made some good music afterwards. They made some mm-hmm. wonderful music afterwards. Mm-hmm. But the four of them together is something, it becomes one thing, one unit. And that was extraordinary. And again, it can never be repeated or duplicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when they broke up, they all had success, of course. Mm-hmm. And McCartney went on with Wings. But one of those who reportedly was not happy with Paul McCartney's work was one Ringo Starr. And a listener has asked me about this, and I pulled up the lyrics to Back Off Boogaloo, and this apparently was written by Ringo Starr, but apparently was about McCartney and his work after he left the Beatles. Wake up, meathead, don't pretend that you are dead. Get yourself up off the cart, get yourself together now, and give me something tasty. Everything you try to do, you know it sure sounds wasted. Now, Ringo has since said that was not about Paul McCartney, but apparently it was.
Well, Ringo and Paul appeared on this recent Beatles special.
Yeah, they did.
Celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That was a Grammy, a post-Grammy Award special, and Ringo and Paul are there. I'm sure that they're good friends now.
Do you recall where you were when John Lennon was killed?
Well, I, you know, had been a huge Beatles fan, and unfortunately I didn't get to see him, although I had a shot, but my parents didn't let me go.
Yeah.
This was 1966.
And this would have been in Richmond? Richmond?
They were at DC Stadium in Washington. And so I wanted to go. I was
Which
a huge
became
fan.
RFK Stadium, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if it still exists anymore. Was it knocked down, Jim? You know these things.
Well, the new park is right next door. It's been knocked down. But it was one of the big places. Of course, one of the most famous concerts was at another ball stadium, Shea Stadium. The Beatles in, what, 65, I think?
They were there in 65, and I don't know if they went back in 66 or not. They might have. We've got a lot of details about their 64 tour in our story in the paper today. 64 had to be the zenith of this whole Beatlemania in America. But even so, in 65, they had 55,000 people at Shea Stadium, which is an extraordinary number. Mm-hmm. And that whole concert is recorded. And Ed Sullivan introduces the group. And so that's one good example of what they would have been like in concert. And you can actually hear the songs in the film, too.
All right. Well, a question from David, and I'll pose it to both of you. Your favorite Beatles song or songs?
Oh, Lord.
John, why don't we let you start?
Well, there are so many songs, and that's one of the things that's extraordinary about the Beatles. They wrote song after song after song that was either great or very good. Can you think of a bad song they wrote? Unless it was some sort of joke like Rocky Raccoon.
And even that was pretty good.
Even that's pretty good, yeah. And even the songs that Ringo sang and wrote are good. I like What Goes On, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't think Ringo wrote that, but Ringo sings.
Ringo
it.
Had
and John
a
and Paul
of number one hits, but
Ringo did very well after right. his after
you,
the Beatles.
But you didn't give a song. You can certainly pick one or two, can't you?
A favorite song. It's easier to pick my favorite album. That's another thing the Beatles did.
Right,
they began to create albums that were basically an entire artistic statement. So I would Rubber Soul has been my favorite album. I believe it was released in December of 65.
Mm-hmm. Not Helter Skelter.
No, That would be one of my lesser favorites.
Not Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Many people picked Sergeant Pepper. And Sergeant Pepper was one of those cultural moments in the 1960s, and lots of people have the same story. My instance with Sergeant Pepper was, bought the album. It was amazing because physically it opened up.
Right.
It was a gatefold and had that huge picture of the Beatles in their Sergeant Pepper uniforms. And I played the entire record once through, both sides. I mean, not playing a song, but the entire record. And then I had to play it again, straight through the entire record. I had to hear it twice, all the way through. Because it's, you know, it's an amazing
statement. Don't
you think
their work was much better as after 1964?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. They grew, they changed, they evolved. That's another one of the great things about them is that they didn't stop growing artistically.
Well, they were gone by 1970 as a group, and of course by 1980, December 8th, John Lennon was dead, and think there really was only 16 years between 64 and 80, and now 34 years have elapsed since, and yet we're still talking about them, and they're still relevant for people who were not alive when they were performing. So they must have something.
Well, it's called classic. A classic is something that withstands the test of time, decades, changing taste. Their music was of such a quality, is of such a quality, that it endures and people come to it again and again, now multiple generations.
All right. 297-5633, a few more minutes with John Wirt of the Baton Rouge Advocate and Jerry Teasley, who was at City Park in 1964. How many people did that stadium hold?
Well, the figure I have is 12,000. I also saw 13,000. I don't know if that's a sellout or not. I mean, it was a good deal of people, obviously.
At $5 a ticket, so that'd be about a gate of about 60,000, and yet they got a $150,000 guarantee, didn't they?
That's what I was told by Bruce Spitzer, the Beatles historian.
So they must have lost money, or the promoters must have lost, unless they sold a whole lot of trinkets.
Don't know the details, the merchandise. There was an extraordinary amount of Beatles merchandise in that time, though.
All right, and I'll let a listener who has inquired veer off the topic for just a moment, since we're talking about gates and prices for concerts. Don McLean, he put on a great show a few weeks ago, and John, I'm told that that's only the third time in his career that a concert has lost money. It was really a sad crowd as far as the number. It was a raucous crowd, but it was a very small one.
The promoter told me 329 tickets were sold. So add a few comps to that, like myself.
And me.
And Jim Engster. Maybe there were 350 people there. Well, it's just obvious that people in Baton Rouge were not so interested in seeing Don McLean. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Well, see, now, there's a guy, his big hit, biggest hit, American Pie,
1971.
72 or so. 71, I think. 71? May 26th, he recorded it, 1971. But
he knows.
But to some, he's no longer relevant. But the Beatles, if any one of them were to perform at the River Center, and there are only two left, even if it were Ringo, I think he'd get more than 329 people, John Wirt.
Yes, indeed. Ringo's out doing his own shows. Paul is doing his show, his own shows.
Who was your favorite Beatle? Jerry?
Well, you know, Paul. I mean, everybody loves Paul. But, you know, now that I know better and I'm a grown-up person, I think I'd have probably gone with George.
George Harrison.
Yeah.
He was good. Frank Sinatra said he wrote the greatest song of all time, according to Sinatra. Something.
Yeah. He didn't say George wrote it.
He said Lennon and McCartney wrote it.
That's right. You're exactly right. He did. He said it was the greatest song, but he had the songwriter wrong. It was George Harrison.
Usually it is Lennon and McCartney, but in this case it was Harrison.
Well, usually it was McCartney. Why did Lennon get his name in front of McCartney on so many songs that he didn't contribute that much to?
What I read in one of the Beatles histories is that John Lennon and Paul McCartney made a deal. We're going to put Lennon McCartney on every single song universally. That's just where we're going to do it. It doesn't matter whether it's more Lennon's song or more McCartney's song. Mm-hmm. Think about a song like Yesterday. From what I've read, McCartney wrote Yesterday all by himself, and there are no other Beatles on the recording. It's a string quartet. backing Paul McCartney and Paul playing his acoustic guitar. But if you look at the credit, it's Lennon McCartney.
All right. Well, Gerald writes that his favorite song is Yellow Submarine.
That was a funny...
A Ringo song. Ringo huh?
song. That was yeah. a Ringo song, yeah.
Ringo, so Ringo has his pull, absolutely.
I People, think he does. He's got a very distinct singing voice. Well, a very distinct voice, period. But he really does. And it lends itself well to the kind of quirky songs that they let him sing.
And he married a Bond girl.
Yes.
How about that? Barbara Bach.
Yes.
Ringo Starr got the biggest
right.
catch.
They co-starred, I believe they met when they co-starred in the movie Caveman.
Yeah, they
from
did.
1980.
They did.
And I think Caveman's a nice little film. I enjoyed it. But that's where Ringo met Barbara, and she's a beautiful actress,
right.
as you say, a Bond girl.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, he's a Beatle. Mm-hmm. Hey, he's going to have...
Yeah, really.
He can have a beautiful wife.
What's the joke about the drummers in the band?
But sitting right in that chair a few years ago was one Rex Reed, who the movie critic who went to LSU
right.
and then went to
Great
New York.
Critic.
Lived at the Dakota and was a neighbor of John Lennon, and he said that Lennon's blood was on him as he helped him into the ambulance on December 8th, 1980.
So tragic.
Yeah, at 40 years old. Think of the art that man would have produced between 1980 and the present.
Well, he had revived his music career at that. That's right. Part of the tragedy is that he and Yoko had released their album, Double Fantasy, just weeks before he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And he already had a second album completed. And I read back in that time that I'm in Richmond, Virginia. I'd never had the chance to see the Beatles as much as I wanted to see them. But some promoter in Virginia was making plans to bring John Lennon to Hampton Roads on the eastern shore of Virginia. And John would not only have made more recordings, he would have gone out and performed. So all that stuff we lost. And it's still... I mean, decades went by. You can't believe that someone like John Lennon is gone.
All right. Here's another question from Greg. Can you, John, compare the Beatles to the Rolling Stones?
Well, it's like black and white. What do you think, Jerry? You were there.
That's like comparing apples to oranges as far as I'm concerned. You know, the Rolling Stones are great in their own right. They're still around, thank God, you know, that they're still here. Most of them, anyway. You know, it's just a whole completely different thing. I don't look at the Stones as being the writers that the Beatles were. You know, when you look back on the albums that the Beatles made, everything is different. You know, it's like they were geniuses. I mean, they were actual musical geniuses. That's all.
Well, the Stones have stood the test of time, and they opened their most famous concert tour at the Baton Rouge Assembly Center, the LSU Assembly Center, before it was the Pete Maravich Assembly Center.
Well, Jim, were you there?
I was not there. No, I was in high school in Little Rock, but
okay.
I read about it. I remember they had a very controversial phallic-shaped symbol with them on stage that created quite a storm. Probably sold a lot of tickets too because of that. But the Beatles, they were G-rated, weren't they, Jerry?
Oh yes, they were G-rated.
G for Jerry.
That's it.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank
Jerry
you for
Teasley
having us.
And John Wirt. And we shall return after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And we're joined now by Thomas Groves, Assistant Commissioner of Administration for Governor Bobby Jindal. He works for Christy Nichols. And there have been a number of stories over the last few weeks and months about the Office of Group Benefits. And yesterday, a searing editorial from Representative Ted James of Baton Rouge and the Advocate saying, once again, the Jindal administration resorts to peddling distortion and disinformation rather than coming clean with the truth. This time we're writing about the coming increased health care costs to state employees and retirees insured through the Office of Group Benefit. What is your version of what is reality in this case, Thomas Groves?
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me. I guess there's a couple of clarifications we do want to make, but I do want to take some time and talk about what is actually happening with the plans. But let me go ahead and get to some of those clarifications and what was going on in the and not just that editorial, but in a number of others. One of the first things I want to clarify is I'm sure you've read or heard or have seen things about what's called a reserve balance, and there's a lot of confusion that's being created around that. Well, for starters, I want to clear up something. That is, that reserve balance is created from when premiums exceed expenses, and that money is put aside when that happens. And that money is only used for claims and administration of the plan. It is not used in any to pay for any general state funds or any other expenses. Over time, that reserve skyrocketed and got to about $500 million because premiums were outpacing expenses so rapidly. This was done basically on the backs of our members and on the backs of the agencies. And what you have to do is you have to ask yourself, what should that reserve fund be? And the answer to that is not a philosophical answer. It's an actuarial answer. And even if you try to answer it philosophically, you have to ask yourself, is $500 million where it needs to, is where that point should be? In order to keep that fund at $500 million, we would have had to raise premiums by at least 6% every year. And that's less money coming out of employees' pockets, that's less money in the classrooms, that's less money coming out of agencies, and you have to ask yourself why. Again, philosophically, it doesn't make sense. So when we get to issues like this, we don't look at it philosophically. We ask ourselves actuarially, where should that fund balance be? And our actuaries tell us it should be between 113 and 220 million. And I don't know about you, and I'm sure the business you're in, you deal with philosophies and marketing folks, but insurance companies use numbers. We'll leave the philosophies up to marketing folks, and I'm sure you, like I said, I know you deal with marketing folks, but you don't want them working on your numbers. Our fund balance, our cash balance right now, sits at about $370 million. And I think we're getting that cleared up, and folks are starting to understand that fund balance is where it is and why. But the questions they're asking now is, what are we going to do to keep it there? And in the insurance business, I'm sure you know that the Kalmbach Care Act wasn't passed because everybody was happy with their premiums. In the last 15 years, average family premium has doubled. That premium is, for us, being a self-insured group, is basically the cost of services to a healthcare provider times the number of times they're used.
All right. Well, Ted James in his editorial, Thomas, says the analysis using OGB's own data shows the average annual cost to plan members may increase by 47% from $3,533 to $5,187. Is that, first of all, is that an accurate number? And secondly, if it is, could it have been avoided?
First of all, it's not. Let me explain to you where he got that from. And it's not Representative James's fault of his interpretation of the Legislative Fiscal Office's report. Let me clean up that report. And we've been working with them, trying to get them to do some clarity on it. Let me tell you what they did. Ever since that came out, I've been diving into that report, trying to figure out where they got this number from. What they did was they took and to quote their report, they said 47% increase in the average out-of-pocket cost. And that's not what they calculated. They did a calculation on the average out-of-pocket maximum for our current four plans that we offer today and added the premiums to that. Then they took the average out-of-pocket maximum and the premiums and averaged that to compared that to the average out-of-pocket for the four plans plus the two new plans that we have, and that showed the out-of-pocket cost going up by, the out-of-pocket maximum is going up by 47%, not the out-of-pocket cost. So I dove in and I did some research, and I looked into the 75% of our members are on HMO. So I looked at the HMO claims, and only 3% of our members hit the out-of-pocket maximum. When you also consider that a single employee on a single plan on the HMO, their average spend was $250, and for a family it was $466. It's clear that out-of-pocket max is not the out-of-pocket cost. Again, we've asked for clarification from the LFO. I'm hoping that comes soon. We're asking folks we're asking legislators to please get that question clarified, because it's just creating more confusion. We did talk to the rep yesterday, and I think he understands now that that's not the actual cost. Premiums are not going up 47%, and the actual out-of-pocket costs are not going up 47%.
All right.
The LFO also ran a scenario where they compared a hospital claim from one plan to another, from an old plan, current plan to one of the new plans. Well, they compared the HMO plan to the PPO plan, not an HMO plan to an HMO plan. So, again, I think there needs to be more clarity around these numbers.
Okay, well, this is a story that will be with us for a while, and I hope we have the chance to revisit with you or Commissioner Nichols sometime very soon. Thank you, Thomas.
You got it. Anytime.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye. 297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined now by Jacqueline Woodson. She is an accomplished writer, the winner of the Margaret A. Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Writing for Young Adults. Jacqueline Woodson's latest work is Brown Girl Dreaming. Her work is filled with strong African-American themes, generally aimed at a young adult audience. And good morning to you, Jacqueline Woodson.
Good morning.
This is an odyssey that's been quite interesting for you, and you write about topics that some people shy away from. That would be fair to say, wouldn't it?
I think so, although I never understand why.
Well, you're an openly gay person with a lifelong partner and two children. I'm sure because of that, that has not only shaped your writing career, but it also has given you some experiences in life that many of us have not had.
Huh? You know, I guess so. It's interesting. I think, but I do think people shy away from stuff out of fear, and I think part of what my life has been about is trying to live without fear, because I think it slows us down and stops us sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in Ohio?
No, I was born in Ohio, and I left there when I was an infant and moved to Greenville, South Carolina, where my maternal grandparents were.
Okay.
And then I moved here to Brooklyn.
So you have a southern experience, and some believe that life is vastly different in our part of the world. Was South Carolina much different than where you are now?
It was, because I grew up during the Civil Rights Movement and during Jim Crow, with Jim Crow in place, and after Jim Crow, with the fringes of it still a big part of the South, and then, you know, in New York, it was different.
Well, you have taken on some topics that others may find difficult, and particularly about the role and the position of black women in our society. There are a lot of misconceptions, aren't there?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about all women, sadly, in our society. And I do think that one thing I learned from writing Brown Girl Dreaming is how strong women have to be, and black women and all women. I mean, I think there is a way in which the battle we're fighting continues, sadly, and our sense of power and visibility in the world is kind of a lifelong battle.
You're a triple minority. You're black, you're a woman, and you're gay.
I don't consider any of them minorities.
Well, the
you
world...
You know, other people might, but I don't. I you know, I consider them a part of an identity that's a human majority. So I think it's it was so funny, because I ran into a teacher and she was talking about her classroom, and she said, you know, the majority of my students are minorities, and I'm like, isn't that an oxymoron? You know, if they're the majority they're the majority.
Yeah,
and I said, you know, I think part of what I think about as a writer is language and how language impacts us, and the power of language. And I think for myself, I never think of myself as a minority. I think of myself as a woman who is a person of color, who is gay, who is in the world, and how are all of these things going to make me a better human being? And I tend not to use qualifiers unless they're necessary to empower someone else.
You have written about sexual abuse.
I've written about sexual abuse. I've written about kids on white kids who get addicted to meth. I've written about kids coming out. I've written about boys falling in love, you know, black boys falling in love with white Jewish women. I've written about bullies. I've written 30 books, and I've pretty much covered ground across lines of race and economic class and sexuality and gender. And it's because I write realistic fiction, and I don't want anyone to ever feel invisible. I think young people deserve to see reflections of themselves in literature. There isn't just one kind of family. There isn't just one kind of child. There isn't just one race. So I do, I cross a lot of lines in writing.
And you're also a Jehovah's Witness. And
I'm not anymore.
I
grew up a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay, but you followed rules that friends didn't understand. What were some of those?
We didn't pledge to the flag, and we had to leave the classroom during birthdays. We didn't celebrate birthdays or holidays. And, you know, I miss those birthday cupcakes. and, you know, we were in the world, but we were not of the world. And so it was pretty disciplined in a lot of ways. And one of the many gifts I got from growing up in a religious family was the ability to be able to sit quietly for many hours and contemplate things. So that helps as a writer tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brown Girl Dreaming is an award-winning and critically acclaimed book that is out and about, and Jackie Woodson shares a poignant and gritty and memories of her childhood that are quite vivid from her prose, which is quite substantial. And if you have one entry that you in particular would like to share with us, I would welcome that opportunity to hear from you. Is there something that you would like to choose among the many fine poems that are featured in this book?
I'm going to read First Grade, if that's okay.
That sounds wonderful.
First Grade. My hand inside my sister's hand, we walk the two blocks to PS 106. I am 6 years old, and my sister tells me our school was once a castle. I believe her. The school stretches for a full city block. Inside, marble stairs wind their way to classrooms filled with dark wood desks, nailed down to dark wood floors polished to a high and beautiful shine. I am in love with everything around me, the dotted white lines moving across my teacher's blackboard, the smell of chalk, the flag jutting out from the wall and slowly swaying above me. There is nothing more beautiful than Public School 106, nothing more perfect than my first grade classroom. No one more kind than Miss Fiedler, who meets me at the door each morning, takes my hand from my sister's, smiles down, and says, "Now that Jacqueline is here, the day can finally begin." And I believe her. Yes, I truly believe her.
Outstanding. 30 books you've written along the way, and you're still a young person, at least younger than I am. So you've got a lot of great work ahead. What's your focus right now?
This morning, it's getting my six-year-old on the school bus for next week. He just started first grade. And I don't know. I'll see. I'm taking a rest. I'm about to start my book tour, and I might take my 12-year-old with me to some of the places. But I'm exhaling. It's nice to be on the bestseller list. It's nice that Brown Girl Dreaming is getting so much attention. And I'm going to let it sink in and enjoy it a little.
And an interview on another program on NPR, you said that you use very few curse words.
Mm-hmm. I think of cursing as cliched. I think as writers, one of our jobs is to create language that is deeper than something as easy as curse words. And I don't think it's necessary. I think it's you don't need them, and I think they break the dream of fiction. So if you're reading some really nice writing and suddenly there's informal language in it, it is jarring, and that's not what I want to do. I want to pull the reader in and hold them without having to be cliche.
Mm-hmm. Must have been quite a thrill, Jacqueline, when Spike Lee was captivated with one of your works enough to make it a miniseries.
That was great, and now Jonathan Demme is making another work on a movie, so I feel doubly blessed. So I like working with directors. I like that people I've only seen on the big screen are interested in my work. So, yeah, it was great working with him, and it was great working with the cast of Miracles Boys. And now we'll see what Jonathan Demme does with Beneath the Meth Moon.
Yeah. As a writer, do you feel like you're mellowing, getting better with age?
I always say to people, read from the beginning to the end. Don't read me backwards, because the writing's going to get worse as you go closer to the beginning of my writing career. You know, I've learned so much about the world and so much about myself and so much about writing by writing.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. It is a book that has received worthy plaudits. Ms. Woodson, the New York Times writes with a sure understanding of the thoughts of young people, offering a poetic, eloquent narrative that is not simply a story, but a mature exploration of grown-up issues and self-discovery. Thank you, Jacqueline Woodson.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we shall return Monday for Frank Barnett. I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.